This episode of Guitar Radio Show is brought to you in part by...
With a unique design and construction, DNA Guitars is a clear choice when looking for the all-around guitar. DNA Guitars' recipe for creating perfect instruments is steeped in tradition while looking toward the future. DNA's recessed bridge construction is a five-point contact bridge, a solid brass bridge that is inset into the body, maximizing strength, contact, and string vibration. An incredibly comfortable guitar to play, DNA Guitars molds to your body, and the neck profiles are wonderful to play across. DNA uses an exclusive 100% solderless wiring harness that is designed for guitars with single coil or humbucker setup. Looking for versatility? Look no more. Check out DNA Guitars. Go to dnaguitarcompany.com. Custom guitars handcrafted in the USA. DNA Guitars. Innovation to fuel your inspiration.
And also by...
Hey everybody, Mark Davin from Guitar Radio Show. Have you heard about Lock Knob? LockKnob.com? Lock Knob is a revolutionary product invented by a musician for musicians, solving the long-time problem of lost settings. How many times have you been at a gig or a session only to have to reset all of your settings on your amp or your pedals because they move during transit? You can upgrade your existing knobs on your amp, pedals, mixer, guitar, almost anything with a pot, with an all-aluminum quality made reusable knob that does more than just look pretty. Never lose your settings again. Lock it down with Lock Knob. Go to LockKnob.com for more.
Welcome to Guitar Radio Show, the show dedicated to the guitar player, guitar maker, gear builder, and purveyors of such items that you may not know about, but should. Here's your host, Mark Davin.
Hey everybody, welcome to episode 158, Guitar Radio Show. So glad you tuned in. Today you're going to be very pleased. I'm so lucky to do what I get to do every week here for you guys. I get to talk to my heroes, I get to talk to legends, and it's always really cool when you get to speak to a legend that's also your hero. And today's one of those days. We get to talk with Mr. Steve Hunter. For me, he came on the scene for me when he was with Alice Cooper and, of course, with Lou Reed. The Rock and Roll Animal record was just, like, amazing. We talk about that a little bit in there, about me trying to cop licks. But he's played with Peter Gabriel and on and on and on. With so many people, and he's got some new stuff that's coming out really soon, so we're really excited about that. We talk about that as well. He is going to be working with Jason Becker, has been in the past, and will be again. He's a Renaissance man. You know, there are some of them out there still, and Steve Hunter is one of those guys. So you get to hear that today. I want to thank Karen Hunter for helping set this whole thing up. She really helped make the process really smooth and seamless. So thank you, Karen. And I just want to remind you all, guitarradioshow.com for all your .com needs, whatever they may be. Come on over there and say hello. 2017 is really shaping up to be a very different year for Guitar Radio Show. It's going to be a little bit of a facelift. We're hoping for a change in the website. We're hoping for there's going to be some format changes. And for me, there's a whole bunch of other things going on. I just finished a meeting on with Adam Hunt on a book that he and I are planning to write. And I'm really excited about that. I'm not going to tell you too much more about that because I don't want to let the cat out of the bag just yet. But we're really excited about that. And I'm finally going to get to record some new music, and I haven't recorded any music in a while of my own. So that's going to be fun. And I'm working on more films in 2017 with a lot of the Austin independent filmmakers, and I'm really excited about it. So it's going to be a really great year, and I'm really looking forward to it. We got a lot of great people coming up for the rest of the month. We've got Scott Van Zen and Alistair Green. And you're going to be really blown away by those cats. They're amazing. And then we're looking ahead into the new year, right into the new year. We've got Tony McAlpine, Rick Avito. Oh, goodness, who else? A whole bunch of other folks. Let's see here. Let me move this over here. Move this screen over. Lightbulb Vaporizer, Rick Vito, like I said. Too Slim and the Tail Draggers. Tim Langford, man, I love that guy. And we had a great conversation with him. John Harrington from Steely Dan and Gonzalo Bergara, who is best known for being a flamenco and classical guitar player who went back to the roots of his of who he loves, and it's the blues. You might hear my cat in the background. He's here at the studio with me today, and he's being very noisy. Now he's not making any sound. Oh, well. Anyway, I'm going to play a little snippet of some Steve Hunter, and then we're going to get right into it. You ready? Here we go. Guitar Radio Show. GuitarRadioShow.com. All right, people, our next guest has played on and has been involved in some of the most iconic albums and songs of the 20th century. They call him the Deacon. We have Mr. Steve Hunter. How are you, Steve?
I'm doing great, Mark. Thanks. How are you?
I'm well. Welcome to Guitar Radio Show. It's great to have you on.
Thank you. My pleasure.
I have to start by telling you a story.
All right.
Years ago, I was in this was 19, I'm going to say it's probably 1981 or 82. I was in a cover band in New York, and we were really digging on the Rock and Roll Animal album.
Right.
And the whole intro section to Sweet Jane, and of course Sweet Jane itself, that version of Sweet Jane, which is very different than the original version. And me and another guitar player said, "Oh man, we gotta do this. We gotta do it note for note." And and we argued over who was going to play your part.
I'm not sure I could play it note for note, right now, to be honest.
Well, we went ahead and we learned it, and we both learned your part, and we argued back and forth as who's going to play Dick's part.
Well, you should just trade every night.
He wouldn't do it. He wouldn't go for it.
Oh, I see. Okay. That's a shame.
But it was a blast to play, and it was such a, it was such a change for Lou Reed at that time, I think.
Probably was a bit of a change, yeah.
It was almost legitimizing him in a way.
I don't know if I'd say that.
Well, at that time, it was sort of, he was still this kind of outsider. He wasn't who he ended up becoming, and is like a legend yet.
Well, what I mean is, when I heard Walk on the Wild Side, that knocked me off.
That's oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I thought, wow, man, this guy, I didn't know who he was until I heard that.
And yeah.
I thought, wow, man, this guy has got some real balls.
Yeah.
To say the things that he said and have that be a yeah. single.
Yeah.
And it was accepted, you know. Yeah. I thought, wow, man, that is the coolest thing in the world.
Yeah.
I loved him from that moment on.
Yeah. What was it like to work with him?
Well, see, I thought it was great to work with him. In back in 73, when I first kind of first met him and stuff, he was pretty quiet, you know. I never talked much with him. We never socialized a lot. I could feel there was a really nice mutual respect. He loved my guitar playing. I loved his songs, and so we had this wonderful mutual respect thing. And when we did talk, it was cool. But he was pretty quiet in those days. Now later on, when I rejoined up with him to do the Billion Dollar Babies, I'm jumping ahead on the Berlin show,
right?
Suddenly he's like this really funny guy. I mean, he had an incredible sense of humor, and we just became instant pals, like all over again. It was really wonderful. There was some sort of rapport we had from having a history together, I think.
Yeah.
That just as soon as he walked on stage and he saw me and we shook hands, it just became instant. I think we were both a little nervous at first, you know. We didn't know how each other was going to react. But once we were kind of over that, he and I just became instant pals, and I just loved him. Had so much fun with him.
That's great. He was always this, I don't know, sort of like this dark character to me, you know, this mysterious. He was mysterious.
Yeah, see, and that's what I liked about him.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the cool thing about him was that he represented a part of New York that I was fascinated with.
Right.
But I was too chicken to get involved in, you know. I was too afraid to get involved in. But I thought that world was fascinating. The Andy Warhol thing and all that underground stuff. I absolutely loved it. And if I could have gotten to New York a little bit earlier and got my hands in, I probably would have. But he represented that to me, and so I was fascinated by his take on it and his lyrics and what he thought and how he perceived it and all that stuff. It fascinated the hell out of me, so I was thrilled to be working with him because of that.
Yeah, it was a really interesting. I mean, that record in particular, the Rock and Roll Animal album, for me has a lot. I mean, you know, obviously because we were going ahead and we were learning it, and we were really absorbing it on a whole other level than just listening to it. You know, when you sit down and you really try to learn another player, the way they do something. It ends up teaching you something.
Oh, absolutely. That's how I learned how to play guitar.
Yeah. Speaking of which, you grew up in Illinois, right?
Yep. Yeah, yeah.
Was it Decatur, was it?
That's it, yeah.
Yeah. So I know Illinois has always been a hotbed and was a hotbed for really good music. Was it local musicians that were doing it for you, or was it British Invasion, or what?
Yeah, you know, when I think back on it, it's probably pretty weird to people. Well, like if you're from the best way to describe it is, if you're from New York or Los Angeles or Chicago, any other really major city, you sort of have your finger on the pulse, really, mm-hmm. of what's going on, because you're going to get most of that stuff almost immediately. Whereas in Decatur, it has to kind of filter down, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we heard all the same things that everybody was hearing. We heard the British Invasion, which is one of my favorite times in music, because of the Beatles and the Stones and the Standell, all the bands that were coming out. Well, I hope the Standells were out of England. I don't remember now, but all the wonderful bands coming out of England and what they were doing with music was absolutely fascinating to me. The Cream, you know, and Zeppelin.
Mm-hmm.
But what ended up happening is they kind of turned me on to the blues, which I didn't really know what the blues was. I had heard of this guy named Michael Bloomfield, And I finally heard some of his music, along with Eric Clapton, with Cream. And I read interviews with these guys, and they're starting to talk about blues. So when I started playing in local bands, or I started looking, going to see local bands, I was trying to sort out what this blues was. Mm-hmm. And I finally did get my hands on some blues records, Albert King, B.B. King in particular, Freddie King, all of the guys, Elmore James, all those guys. And I started, when I started listening to it, I fell madly in love with it. So now when I'm in a band, in a local band, I have to play blues because I'm just fascinated by it. And I go seek out, I was seeking out local bands that play blues, you know. But the whole impact on me of the British invasion was probably the most important as far as turning my head around musically. Because even though Jimi Hendrix was American, you know, he came from England, really. You know, he had gone over and formed the experience in England. And when I first heard him, he just blew me away, of course. Mm-hmm. And Eric Clapton blew me away, and Jimmy Page, and all these guys from England. I kept thinking, what's going on over there? You know, that the music is so incredible. So that whole British invasion thing really did it for me more than anything.
And was there one particular guitar player from that whole scene that really resonated?
Like I say, it started out with Michael Bloomfield, who was, of course, from the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area.
Right.
And I was starting to pick up that, well, maybe there's something going on over there. You know, remember, I'm in Decatur, Illinois, and I don't even know what the Bay Area looks like.
Right.
You know? And I'm hearing about this guy, Michael Bloomfield, and I'm hearing about this guy named Paul Butterfield. And Jefferson Airplane, and I'm hearing about all these sort of psychedelic blues, but I didn't really get what was going on with them until I heard Clapton with Cream.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as I heard "Sunshine of Your Love," that solo,
mm-hmm.
and the tone and the vibrato and all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Now you got to keep in mind, by that time I had sort of discovered B.B. King, so I was starting to learn a little bit about blues. But when Clapton came out with Cream, when I heard that, that's what I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's what I wanted to do.
It's interesting.
I wanted the guitar to sing like that.
Yeah, it's interesting too that, you know, because I actually have in my notes here that your lead work is always very lyrical. Yet it's got this cutting edge to it. You can be very delicate, yet you can be very ferocious when you play.
Well, good. Okay, good. Because that's what I'm trying to do, and that's good. That's coming across that way. A lot of that came from B.B. King, because B.B. King could put together a solo of six notes that would tear your head off.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
And I was fascinated by that kind of power and that much expression that could come out of an electric guitar. And then, of course, Clapton, you know, you would hear the single "Sunshine of Your Love," and then you would hear the live version, which would be like 20 minutes long, and mm-hmm. there'd be all this incredible guitar playing in it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what really blew me away. Suddenly, these guys were blowing the walls off of music. Music had been all boxed in for many years.
Sure.
And now all of a sudden, guys like Hendrix and Page and all these guys are blowing the walls off. And I wanted to jump right in. I really did, because I loved it. I thought it was absolutely the most wonderful thing to experience. Playing-wise and listening.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting, you know, when I hear you play, you have this way of... I mean, with the stuff you did with Alice, the stuff you did with Aerosmith, the stuff you did with, you know, on your solo stuff, and even with Lou Reed, it's you seem to like dig in with the pick a little bit. Is that something that was? Is that just a natural occurrence, or is that something that was kind of?
Yeah, you know, I think it was natural. They talk about, you know, the practicing of 10,000 hours and all
that
stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And usually, you know, you and I probably both did the same thing. It was 10,000 hours playing in bar bands.
Yeah, exactly.
And playing cover tune. Man, that's a great way to learn how to play. That's one of the best schools on earth, is to get your ass in front of an audience. And now you can't just practice. You have to perform. So then you learn how to perform. I mean, I mean, the Beatles did what they played strip joints in Hamburg for a year, learning how to play their instruments. And I think that's a really good way. So I learned a lot by playing, like you said, playing cover tunes, playing other people's songs, especially B.B. King. One of the bands I was in, you know, we, in the old bar bands, you had to do like five sets, like 8 till 2 in the morning. And we would do one entire set of B.B. King stuff because we all love B.B. King so much.
Right.
And, so it was a great training ground for me to learn how to play, you know, just to learn how to play. So I learned a lot of different kind of technical things, like with my pick. Now, as I went through my career, I started using the pick less and less.
Uh-huh.
Because I liked the expression you can get from your fingers is to me, it's almost limitless compared to a pick. Having said that, a pick still has its uses for me. When you're doing the rock and roll stuff with the fifths, you got to have pick.
Yeah.
But melodically, when you're playing solos and stuff, sometimes to me, my fingers. I just did a session the other day where I didn't use a pick at all. I didn't even. I had one out and I never used it. I used my fingers, you know. I just like the expression that you could get and the tone quality. You know, I love the tone that Albert King used to get using his thumb, you know.
Yeah. That's a guy who I discovered late and realized how many other people had really kind of nicked his gig.
Oh yeah, man. Well, Stevie Ray Vaughan just
totally
loved him. You can tell, you know.
Oh, yeah.
He just loved him, and I did too. I loved his bending stuff and his vibrato and yeah, his phrasing and everything was just. And then he just with that thumb, man, he get all these different tones.
Yeah.
You know, God, I don't know how he did it.
Yeah.
It just was a thumb. He must have had a huge callus on it.
You know, doing all the things that you've done and shifting gears in the way that you have over the years. I mean, being a session guy or a sideman or a whatever you want to call it, a hired gun, whatever it is. Is it difficult? I mean, I've done a bunch of studio work in my life, but not on the level that you have and with the type of people and with what was riding on the line of a different project that you might be in. What's it like as far as preparation for you when you go in for something like that?
Well, you know, the wonderful thing is, and I know this is going to sound, I hope this doesn't sound like really ego or arrogant, but I didn't even think about any of those things when I never thought about it. Funny thing is, I was never intimidated or afraid. I was always like, wow, I wonder what's going to happen in here. I was always like a little kid, going to Disneyland for the first time. What's in this room? You know,
mm-hmm.
I honestly never really felt intimidated or like I had to get myself ready for anything. Nothing like all I felt like I can't wait to get started because I enjoyed that so much. I enjoyed the challenge of it, of some of the most difficult sessions. Jack Bruce's solo album was very difficult.
Yeah,
it was very involved in time, different time signatures and chords I'd never heard of, and all kinds of stuff. But you know what? I loved the challenge of it.
Yeah,
and every time it meant that I had to try to work out a way to play the way I play that would fit. You know, and I loved that challenge. It just excited the hell out of me, and I knew. Just like you were saying earlier, I knew I was going to learn something. You know?
Yeah, yeah. So you would show up for like with Jack. You showed up and there were charts, or it was
no. You know, that was funny because I wouldn't have been able to read them anyway. This was back in, I don't know, 72, 73, somewhere around in there. And man, I was just a blues guitar. I was a blues rock player. I didn't know anything about jazz at all. Maybe just a tiny little bit. You know?
Right.
And he would play these chords on the piano, and I think, oh my God, what the hell is that? I don't know. I don't even know where to begin. So what I did, just to have something to work with and see if it was okay with him, I told him, Jack, why don't you give me the upper triad, the top three notes, and give me the root, and let me find something to play. And that's how we did it. Because if he said E minor sharp 11, I wouldn't know what the hell he's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
In those days, I wouldn't have a clue.
Right.
So he would give me the top triad and the root, and then I would just find something that fit. Mm-hmm. And strangely enough, that worked on, that's what I did on the whole album pretty much, and it worked.
Huh.
Yeah, it was really cool.
That's great.
I was so glad it worked because I was afraid he was going to fire me, you know. You know, but he was happy too. He thought, well, this is a good idea. This is a way to do it without me having to give him lessons in music theory, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's interesting, you know, you when I hear it, when I listen back, I've heard that record and I listen back to that, or you know, the stuff you did with Alice and stuff, it's as I said earlier, it's got this ferocious nature to it. It's I guess aggressive would be the word I'd use. But wonderfully so. I mean, because I grew up on listening to, you know, Billion Dollar Babies and Welcome to My Nightmare, and you know. I mean, these are, and it's interesting because the last Guitar Player magazine, which you actually write, you do the session file in Guitar Player magazine every month, which I love. You had written an article about how once the record was done, you had so much fun doing it, and you felt it was just as much your album as it was anybody else's. You know, and that says something to me that you know, that's why that record's so good, is because everybody was so vested in what they were doing.
Oh man, I'm telling you, everybody, the whole band, everybody. This is we treated that record as if it were our record, not Alice's.
Yeah,
Alice was our singer, you see, and it was our record. I mean, I'm not sure he would have been happy to know that, but I think he was very happy to. That we got into it as deeply as we did. I think he really appreciated that.
Yeah.
And it did. As I know there's a lot of people out there that get a little angry when I say that we really enjoyed it. We felt like we were part of the Alice Cooper band.
Yeah.
I'm talking about is the Alice Cooper solo artist band, not the Alice Cooper group. Those guys are all friends of mine, and that's a different entity altogether.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting.
We weren't trying to take their place.
Right.
We were trying to create something new.
Right. Well, it's interesting because, you know, and in that article you talk about, you know, that it was just that. It was going to be Alice's solo record.
Yeah,
and it was going to be different than the Cooper band, but to me, I never saw Alice Cooper the band. I only always saw Alice. You know,
that's funny. I think a lot of people did. Honestly, when I first met them, I first met them back in '71,
mm-hmm.
before 18 had been released,
right?
And I heard. Their name called. This is the band called Alice Cooper. That's how they were presented to me several times. So I could see the band as being called Alice Cooper because that's how they were introduced to me.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went to see them, I actually went to see them do the Billion Dollar Baby show, and I saw the Alice Cooper group. That's what I saw. I didn't see Vincent Furnier was the lead singer of the Alice Cooper group, and that's how I saw it because that's how. They were presented to me, you see, so I didn't have any trouble relating to them as a band. That's just the band name, you know. But then it was weird because when Alice went solo, he took the name Alice Cooper as his name.
Right.
And so now you have an entity, a personality called Alice Cooper,
mm-hmm.
which if when you saw the band Alice Cooper, you saw the entire band forming that group, Alice Cooper, and each one was part of that personality. Michael Bruce was one, Dennis Dunaway was another, Neil Smith was another, Glenn Buxton. They all became this Alice Cooper entity, and it changed. That's what I'm saying. You see, it changed when Vincent Furnier went out and became Alice Cooper. Then the whole thing changed. It was a different thing.
Right.
But it is complicated. I mean, you know, if the band's name was Dump Truck, you know, then if somebody wants to split off and do a solo, he's not going to change his name to Dump Truck, you know. it's not going to make any sense.
Right, that's true.
But when the band's name is Alice Cooper, it's a name, then suddenly you think, well, Alice isn't going to take the name Alice. That's a girl name, you know.
Right.
Well, he did, and I think it was a really smart move for him to do that.
Yeah.
I do.
Yeah.
But I have to say, I absolutely love the Alice Cooper group. When I saw them in Billion Dollar Babies, I wanted to play with them so bad. You know, I wanted to go up there and hope they'd let me sit in and play with them, because they were so good. The vibe they created on stage, how they played their music.
Right.
I've said this before. When I had to learn the old Alice Cooper stuff, the Alice Cooper group stuff for the tour, the solo tour of Alice Cooper, I was getting really frustrated because I couldn't play Glenn's parts the way he played them. I just couldn't get a handle on how he played them. He played them with such, you want to talk about ferocity, mm-hmm. and just attitude and stuff, and just the way he attacked the guitar. Mm-hmm. I couldn't do that, and it was really kind of pissing me off, because I wanted to get that same thing that he got, and I couldn't do it.
Yeah, I think you have to grow up in Detroit for that.
You have to be, and you had to start from scratch like they did.
Yeah,
and develop the band into what they did. Mm-hmm. You can't just jump in and play Glenn's stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I really tried hard, and I just couldn't do it. I used to frustrate the hell out of me that, because I wanted to do it with the same ferocity that I saw on stage and what I heard on the radio, and I just never quite got it. Mm-hmm. So it ended up having to be our version of the old stuff, you know, which was, you know, that was cool too in its own way. But it used to, boy, he frustrated me. I loved him though. We were pretty good friends. I knew all of them.
Yeah. Well, I know I saw the Welcome to My Nightmare tour.
Yeah.
That was 75. It moved into 76, yes. I think. Right.
Yeah. 75. That's right. Yeah.
And I don't know, for everybody that I was with and me, we didn't notice a difference.
Well, that's good. That's good, because I wanted to pay my respects to what those guys had done. They had created such a phenomenal thing with the Alice Cooper group.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people thought it was ragged and rugged and all that stuff, and that's exactly what it should have been. It should have been ragged and rugged, and it was really hardcore, splitting rock and roll. It was awesome.
Yeah,
and
it was new.
I didn't get it myself until I saw him with Billion Dollar Babies. When I did the overdubs on that album, Billion Dollar Babies, I started hearing things in that band that I thought, man, these guys are, you know, this is bigger than 18, you know.
Yeah.
So then when I saw them do Billion Dollar Babies show, it just knocked me out. They were awesome. They were a really great band live. It was just amazing.
Yeah, they were. They really were. When you were talking earlier about Glenn and everything else, it made me wonder, you know, for you, how much of what you do when you're creating for someone else, you're creating for yourself and you're getting ready to play, how much of it is it heart and how much of it is head?
Well, to me, it's all heart. If it's not got heart in it, it's not worth doing.
Mm-hmm.
I've told this story a bunch of times. You probably even heard it, maybe. But B.B. King changed my mind about how I approach guitar playing. Because when I was back in Decatur, I was in a bar band in Decatur. It was a really good band. It was a band called the Light Brigade. And we all were just absorbed with B.B. King. We thought he was the best thing in the world.
Mm-hmm.
We all loved him to death. We, like I said, we did a whole set of B.B. King. We went up to see him in Chicago. We drove 5.5 hours to see him at Mr. Kelly's, which is a pretty cool dinner club in Chicago. And of course, we couldn't afford dinner, so we sat at a bar drinking a couple of really expensive watered down Cokes, you know, just so we could see the show. You know, we kind of had to look around the pillar, you know, that kind of thing. So he was phenomenal. He was just absolutely phenomenal. It just blew me away. So after the show, I looked up towards the stage, and he's standing in front of the stage, just kind of hanging out. And I thought, wow, I could go talk to him. So I ran up to him, and I said, oh, BB, man, you guys, you were great. I probably came off like a slobbering idiot, you know. I don't know, but he just blew me away. And here's my chance to talk to him. And I had gotten quite frustrated with trying to learn how to play blues, because it just seemed like no matter how hard I tried, I couldn't make it sound right. And so I was telling BB this. I said, BB, I've listened to all your records and I play along with you and everything, and I can't make it sound like you. And I said, is it because I'm white that I can't play blues?
Right.
Because I was thinking that blues may be part of a black culture that I may never understand, you know? And he laughed. He thought that was funny. He said, well, no, man, it's got nothing to do with whether you're black or white. It had nothing to do with that. I said, well, I just can't. I don't know. Maybe I don't have soul or anything. And he said, no, look. He said, have you ever been treated bad, really badly by a girl? And I said, well, yeah. And he said, well, do you remember what that feels like, what that felt like? And I said, oh, sure. And he says, well, you put that in your fingers. And as soon as he said that, it was like the sky opened up.
Mm-hmm.
And he just said something that made so much sense, that what was missing in my playing is I was thinking about it too much. I wasn't playing from the heart. And that's what he was telling me. That's mm-hmm. where it's got to come from.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said one other thing to me that both these things altered my whole outlook on guitar playing. He said, listen, man, don't try to copy me. It's cool to learn from the records, but don't try to copy me.
Right.
What you got to do is learn from the records and then make the blues, make it your own. That's what will keep blues alive. So I go home. We drive home another 5.5 hours. I don't think we got home till like 4 a.m. or something. And I was just so cranked by what those things that he said that I couldn't sleep. I kept thinking, my God, this is like what he just told me has made me feel like playing is now a very serious thing. It's not a fun thing. It's not a thing to get girls. It's not a thing to make a few bucks in a club. This is serious.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just made it very serious. And he's also given me the freedom to do it the way I want to do it. It was now when I sat down to play with his records, now I'd work out a couple of phrases. I'd stop the record and mess around with it myself. And it was fabulous. One of the most intense things that had happened in my whole career.
So it inspired you to Woodshed, too.
Yes. Oh, even more than I had been before.
Yeah.
Because now I heard everything he played. I heard it differently. And I didn't have to try to copy him. All I had to do was try to learn the phrases, learn how he played the phrases. But I could make them my own for that.
Right.
Which is that's like the king of blues giving you permission to play him the way you want to.
Yeah.
It was like, oh my God, that altered my thinking. This changed my whole outlook on how I played guitar from that moment on.
Wow.
Yeah, it was powerful.
So when you say it's all heart. So
yes.
So there's no preparation prior?
Well, I mean, I think you could say there might be in some instances. Most of the time when I do a solo, I prefer not to prepare for it. I prefer to let it just happen.
Right.
Because things will happen that my head wouldn't have thought of.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I think you have to do some preparation. But that to me is practice. You know, the preparation is in practicing, and you try fine things. And look, it's like a palette. It's like, if you're practicing and you're noodling around trying to find, oh, that'd be a nice little thing to play there, or here's a cool little way to play this part, or that's the preparation.
Mm-hmm.
Then when you get to the performance, then it comes, now you have this new palette of a few things that you found during practice that are now laid in there so that when you're playing a solo, that you can bring them out.
Mm-hmm.
Because now you have to know what they sound like. You know what I mean? Once you know what they sound like, then the soul part of it just takes over and brings out that thing when it feels like it's the right time. It's a strange feeling. I try really hard not to think too much about a solo. I think in some instances your brain has to have a part in it. Let's say the progression is a little more complicated than just a three. You know, a three chord blues or something, or 12 bar blues or something. Mm-hmm. It may have more changes in it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But then what the brain does is just keep track of the format for you.
Yeah, I get you.
So they kind of work separately and together. You know, it's a weird thing. I don't know how else to describe it, but that's kind of how it works for me.
Well, it's like the overdubs you did for Billion Dollar Babies. Those overdubs are stunning. I mean,
thank you.
They're just, and what's cool about them also is it's amazing now that I'm hearing that, wow, that was kind of off the cuff, and it's still a, a hummable passage.
Well, yeah, you know, I can give you another example. In the Berlin album, the last song is called Sad Song, and there's a melody solo that I did that happens twice in the song, once I play in unison and once I play it in the harmony. Mm-hmm. Now, the way that solo came up, it sounds like it's been written, which I guess in some aspects it has been written. But what I would do is I would just play, improvise, and then Bob Ezrin would say, yeah, you know, I like the first half, is really cool, but the second half is not really happening. So then we would punch in the second half, and I would go off on the second half until we found something that we liked. And then I would overdub a unison line with that. Mm-hmm. And then the second one, I did a harmony. But even though it sounds written, it's still an improvised solo. The second time, I learned the solo and then played the harmony to it. But even when I'm writing a solo, I try to keep the improv in there.
Yeah.
Because, man, I tell you, stuff comes out sometimes that you're just not expecting. It's like, wow, where'd that come from?
Yeah, I've always been a believer that, you know, you can do something off the cuff, and if you captured it on tape, it might be something that you might want to recreate down the road.
Absolutely. Yeah. No question about it.
Yeah.
No question about it. When I'm doing solos now, I almost always hit record, even at the very beginning, even if I'm still working on a sound or whatever, because you might play something that's just a magic little thing that you weren't expecting happen. You might want to use it again, you know. Yeah. So, yeah, that's what I love about improvisation, is that it's just sometimes it's just as much a surprise for you as it is for the audience. Mm-hmm. It's really wonderful.
Yeah, for sure, absolutely. So during your time with Mitch Ryder, that's when you ended up meeting Bob Ezrin.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
That started a career with him. You were you were like, you guys were joined at the hip for years.
For a little while, yeah.
Yeah.
But we still do stuff together. We still every once in a while do something together.
Yeah. What's he like? Because I've heard stories.
Well, see, I love it when people say they've heard stories. I love that. Because usually what I do is I don't validate them or invalidate them. So everybody gets really mad at me, you know, because, well, I heard he was a tyrant. I heard he was a... Well, here's the thing. When I first met him, I had so much respect for his ideas. I didn't even know what a producer was back in 71 when I met him. I had no idea what a producer did.
Right.
You know, and he would come in and he would sort of have these ideas for arrangement and stuff like that. And I thought that were really cool. I thought, wow, you know, that's a cool idea, you know. So that's what he does. And then when we got in the studio, then he's coordinating with the engineer to get the sounds and all that stuff. So then I started picking up what a producer actually does. When it really hit me what a genius he really was, though, was when the Berlin album happened.
Mm-hmm.
And all he had from Lou was a cassette of the song ideas, and he created that whole album from almost nothing. And that's when I realized this guy's a genius, and I learned an immense amount of stuff from him about production, engineering, mixing, all that stuff. A lot of the stuff I do now has been directly from working with him. The ideas I have for arrangement, he can be a real tyrant in some ways, but I think in those days it was perceived that way, and in actual fact it was just that he was doing his job, mm-hmm. which was trying to get everybody coordinated to make a great piece of music.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most producers sort of worked that way in those days. I think it's a lot different now than it was in the 70s.
Yeah.
You know, like with George Martin, you know, when he talked about the Beatles, he was, well, George Martin was a producer that would usually pick the material for the artist.
Mm-hmm.
So, and here he's saying, well, God, these guys come in and they've written all their material.
Yeah.
He said, half my job was done already, you know. And he wasn't a tyrant, but he held his own. In other words, you felt his footprint on stuff,
right.
But it was a really good footprint. It's mm-hmm. the same with Bob. You know, mm-hmm. you feel his impact on it, but it's really good. You know,
well, yeah, that's the thing. I think with some producers actually have a stamp where you can hear them in the artist's work.
Well, you can. Well, like Phil Spector is a good example.
Yeah. Well, for sure.
You can't miss him.
Yeah, and George Martin, for that matter.
And George Martin,
yeah,
exactly.
For sure, absolutely.
There's a certain quality that comes out in their work.
Yeah, 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 yeah. I even heard that with. I mean, I know Eddie Kramer was mostly engineer, but it was almost like he was another musician in the room.
Well, yeah, because I think he created the sound.
Yeah.
That Jimmy had in the studio. I mean, the sound of the band experience. He created that sound.
Yeah.
And I think he was as much a part of the band as the members. Yeah. I really do.
And he did it with four tracks.
Yeah. Yeah, I know.
That's insane.
Yeah, I know.
So, you know, I've always thought of Ezrin as a mad genius, so to speak.
Yeah, that's not a bad way to describe him. You know, I think you could say that about him. I don't think he'd be offended.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think you have to be, look, to be a creative person, in especially in music in those days,
yeah.
Especially with Alice and with something as heavy as the Berlin album with Lou Reed, you almost become a film director without a film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to create. You have to create stuff completely out of thin air. And then when you talk about Alice Cooper, it's got to be this weird sort of horror stuff.
Yeah.
You have to be able to not just work outside the box. You have to destroy the box.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Bob was a genius at bringing that stuff out in Alice. I was in on one of the sessions where Alice was doing a vocal. I think it was on Steven or one of those really, really warped songs on the Nightmare album. And Alice was in the studio on the other side of the glass, and Bob was right up on the glass making these faces and grimacing and stuff at certain lines so that Alice would get the vibe. It was the most brilliant thing I'd ever seen, and he was pulling it out of him. Just like a director would, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he's a motivator.
Oh, absolutely. And he pulls, well, he would do the same thing with me. He'd pull performances out of me that I still to this day can't believe I was able to do what I did. We worked really hard on, for example, the, if you've heard the Welcome to My Nightmare.
Yeah.
On the song I Am Made of You. He and I worked really hard to get that solo just right.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how many different versions of it we tried. We were both on the same page. We wanted it to say something really special.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just his one of his geniuses is he can pull a performance out of you that you wouldn't even expect.
Yeah,
he's really good at that.
Yeah. So I'm curious to know, you know, over the years. I can tell it's you when I hear you play, with the exception of Salisbury Hill. I would have never known that was you.
that's kind of funny in a way. I like that.
But when it comes to your soloing, I can you know, because I've been listening to you for such a long time and been a fan for such a long time, I can tell it's you. But I imagine your gear must have changed over the years. So this has got to throw out the whole idea that, you know, well, this is how I get my sound. It's my gear. But really, it's more like what Billy Gibbons says. It's meat on metal on wood.
See, I love that guy. I love that guy because he's absolutely correct.
Yeah.
He said it a lot better than I would have said it. He says he's one of those guys that says stuff so cool that you just say, yeah, that's it. That's exactly
what you want it on a T-shirt. That's so cool.
I want to put it on on a plaque or something.
Yeah.
Well, he's absolutely right. here's the thing that was really interesting for me. I was teaching at Musicians Institute for a little while, about a year and a half or so. And I love the students. They're so, you know, bless them. They're all coming in their gear. You know, they have hats on and their hair's really long and they have jewelry hanging. And they haven't learned how to play anything yet, but they got the look down, you know.
Right.
And they'll come in my room and they'll plug into the – we had some little Fender practice amps that had all kinds of distortion and effects and stuff. They'll take 10 minutes setting up there. I said, what are you doing? Well, I'm getting my sound. Oh, okay. All right. So I'd let them go all work their butts off getting their sounds all distorted and delay on it and reverb and everything. Now, is that it? Is that your sound? And yep, that's it. That's my sound, man. Okay. Okay, well, today we're not going to use an amp. And that would scare the hell out of them. I would say, okay, well, that's your sound. We'll come back to that later, but unplug the guitar now. Let's see what you do. Let's see what it sounds like when you just play the guitar. And that would scare them to death. I practiced most of my early life, my early career, I practiced without an amp. And it was more out of necessity because at the time I was still living at home. And, you know, I didn't want to have an amp cranked in this little house and I'm practicing for a couple hours a day. I didn't want to bug anybody. So I would just practice with the guitar. Unbeknownst to me, I wasn't like becoming this genius way to learn how to play guitar. Nothing like that. It was just out of necessity. It caused me to listen very carefully and closely to what my fingers were doing on the guitar. And if I could make it sound really good on the guitar, then I knew all the amplifier was going to do was make that louder. We rely too much on the amplifier. The word amplify just means make louder.
Right.
You know, it doesn't mean make your tone. It just makes whatever you're playing on the guitar louder. So once you get it, you can get it to sound really good on a guitar acoustically. Then all you should have to do is plug it into an amp. It's just going to sound the same, only louder. Now, of course, we get into distortion and pedals and all that sort of stuff, and that's all great. But like Billy said, the real tone comes from flesh on metal and wood. That's where it comes from.
Yeah. that's really it's obvious. I mean, because your gear has changed over the years, right? I mean, you're not still playing.
It's changed all over the place. Yeah. I mean, I can't even remember some of the amps I went through. Marshalls and High Watts and Fenders and everything. I mean, you know, but it really shouldn't make any difference. You know, all it should do is just make whatever's coming off the guitar louder. That's all it should do.
Yeah. And that's something I'm learning more and more. You know, that's the thing I love. I've been playing guitar since 1975 and still to this day I learn something new every day, and that's what makes it still fun and
well, you know, it's a tough thing to learn, especially nowadays, because there's such fabulous gear out there.
Yeah.
My God, there is some amazing gear. You can make the worst piece of crap guitar sound amazing in some of the software that's available and some of the amps and stuff. It's amazing.
Yeah.
But the real deal is what comes off your fingers. Yeah. That's the real deal.
Yeah. I once heard a story... actually from the owner of, I'm here in Austin, Texas, and I had heard from the owner of Heart of Texas Music, which is no longer, he had told me that when Stevie Ray came into and discovered that Strat, that famous Strat of his.
I love that guitar.
Yeah, hanging on the wall in the back. he said that Stevie sat with that guitar for about an hour and a half, playing it without an amp.
Yeah.
And then finally, you know, he said, it was Ray Hennig. That's who it was. Ray Hennig said, you going to plug that thing in or what? He goes, yeah, all right. He plugged it in. He played it through an amp for about 5 minutes. And he said, yeah, I'll take it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's really the deal, man. The other thing you can do is when you're testing, if you do want to test a guitar out, what I used to do is plug it through the cleanest amp I could find and just turn the knobs like at 12 o'clock. So they're pretty much like in the middle. Try not to let the amp cheat for you. so that when you hear the guitar with everything pretty flat and it still sounds good, then you know it's going to sound good from that moment on. It's mm-hmm. going to sound great because you can do whatever you want to with it after that.
Yeah.
But I can see with Stevie that if he were playing that guitar, I bet you anything, if I was standing in front of him while he's playing it, it would sound exactly the same way as when he plugs it in.
Yeah.
I'd hear all that vibrato and all that wonderful stuff that he did. Yeah.
So when you did the Manhattan Blues Project, that was a bit of a change for you in that it was this. It's a very lush production. It's not really stripped down. It's lush. It's beautiful.
Thank you.
What was the impetus behind that? What was your thought process for that?
Well, now this is a weird story, really, because I have a really good friend. Her name is Carrie Page. She's a photographer, and she lives in Manhattan. And this one day, it was an early spring day in Manhattan. It happened to be one of those really beautiful days. The sky's completely blue. There's no clouds. It's not too hot, you know. So she grabs her camera and she goes out and takes a bunch of pictures. And one of the pictures she posted on Facebook was one of Central Park, right around sunset, just before sunset. It was a beautiful photograph. And as soon as I saw the photograph, I got this idea for a song.
Hmm.
And I thought, wow, that's amazing that this photograph inspired this song, and which ended up being Sunset Central Park on that album. And so I wrote the piece, and I had already been working on a version of What's Going On, because that's the best single ever recorded. It's the most incredible record.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to do my own version, and I had really wrestled with it because I liked the original version so much. I was having a hard time straying away from it too much. But I finally came up with a version that was slower and a little more, a little deeper sounding, you know. So then I had this idea once I had heard those two together. Excuse me, I got a little bit of a frog in my throat. When I heard the two of them together, I thought, you know, I think I'm going to do a record about Manhattan because I love Manhattan. I used to, in the 70s, I was in and out of there all the time recording. I actually almost moved there a couple times, and it just, for whatever reason, it never happened. But mm-hmm. I really, really love Manhattan. Mm-hmm. I still do.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, I'm going to write an album about the things I know about Manhattan. Like the Chelsea Hotel, I used to stay there all the time. Hotel Chelsea.
Yeah.
I used to stay there all the time. All the time. I loved that place. And for a rehearsal, there was one rehearsal time where I stayed at Gramercy Park. And Salisbury Hill was on the album because I stayed in, we rehearsed in New York. So every time I played that song, it reminds me of New York.
Ah, okay.
So I decided, well, it's got to be kind of a cool, kind of mellow record, because a lot of the records I'd heard that deal with Manhattan or New York City tended to be kind of jazzy, you know. So I didn't want it to be jazzy. I thought maybe I was going to try for the bluesy side of New York, you know. New York's elegant to me. Manhattan is an elegant place, but it's got this underbelly.
Mm-hmm.
And the underbelly is what Lou Reed found.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
He knew that underbelly better than anybody.
Yeah, the Lower East Side.
Yeah, he really did. And the village in the 70s was kind of a rough and tumble place too, you know.
For sure.
So, but I really loved it. You know, I loved all that stuff. So I was going to fill in this little gap where maybe we'll make Manhattan more bluesy. And that's how the album came about. And I wanted it to be kind of lush and dreamy
totally.
You know, all those kind of things, because Manhattan was always like that to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great record. I really like that record
thank
a
you.
Lot.
I had a lot of fun doing it. I just did it all myself, you know. And, I had a couple of, well, I had, you know, I had all those guests. I had Johnny Depp and Joe Perry, but Joe Satriani.
Yeah, Satch is on there.
Which was a real wonderful gift for me. Just all they did was make the album really special to me, you know.
Right.
And I met some good friends. I made some good friends doing that.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
So you're working on a new record.
Yes, I am.
And can you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, the working title right now is Before the Lights Go Out. And the reason it's titled that, it's going to sound a bit, excuse me, it's going to sound a bit, I don't know, like, what would you say? It sounds a little bit sad, but it's really not, kind of. I've had glaucoma in my eyes for 25 years,
uh-huh.
And I've always been told that no matter what I do, eventually I'm probably going to lose all my sight. And, you know, we've done a lot of stuff. I've taken drops, and I've had some surgery. I had a torn detached retina in my right eye, and all kinds of stuff. And my left eye's almost gone. So the last two doctors I saw pretty much said, well, listen, we think the lights are going to go out. And at some point, we don't know. We can't predict how long it's going to take. We don't know whether it'll be a year, 2 years, 10 years. We don't know. So it's sort of like I've got this thing hanging over my head now that I don't know when my eyes are going to just decide to shut off or get so bad that I can't really work,
mm-hmm.
which is a real shame because one of my loves, of course, is making music. So I thought, well, I'm going to call this album Before the Lights Go Out because that's kind of what I'm going to try to do. I'm going to try to get this thing done before the lights go out, you know. So I'm going to try to put on the album, I want it to be a guitar album. I've got a guitar synth. I've got the Go Down Variax, I think it's called.
Yeah.
It's a terrific instrument. It reads MIDI stuff, so I can do stuff in Pro Tools and all that stuff. I love it. It's one of my favorite guitars right now, and I use that a lot to do synth pads and stuff without using a keyboard. So everything is going to be triggered by a guitar in one form or another. And most of the stuff is going to be just guitar,
mm-hmm.
with pedals and effects and all kinds of stuff. I just want it to be, I want to try to make it the most beautiful guitar album ever, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a lofty goal, but I'm going to try. There's going to be more rock stuff on it, more rock and stuff that was on in Manhattan Blues. I have one that's my brother, my second next youngest brother was a Harley Davidson guy, so I have a song that's kind of a Harley Davidson road riding thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be that kind of album. It's going to be very varied, but I think there'll be sort of this theme through the whole thing that
mm-hmm.
that this is just going to be a blast to listen to. That's what I'm hoping. That's my goal.
And do you have an idea of when this might get done?
Well, I'm hoping to have it out before next fall, but maybe a little. It depends on what I do. There's three songs that I have in mind. I'd like to have a couple of musicians play on. So I'm going to have to. We may have to do an Indiegogo thing and stuff like that to get studio time. You know, it depends on how all that stuff goes.
Sure.
But I'm hoping to have it out by next fall,
so,
just before next fall.
So are you telling me that, you know, when you lose your, you know, and I hope it doesn't happen, but when and if you lose your eyesight, you're going to just stop playing?
No, I'll still play, but okay. What I'm saying is I can't see. If I can't see to use Pro Tools, I won't be able to record
okay.
the way I like to record,
right.
You know what I mean? I like to be able to just record whenever I feel like it and
right.
however I want to do it.
Sure,
there's a lot
you.
Of freedom in having Pro Tools, man. That's the most wonderful software for me.
Yeah.
Because I can go in my room and create whatever I want.
See, that's why we need voice-activated Pro Tools.
Yeah. Well, you know, there is a program. There's an app that's been written that will tell you where the cursor is on the screen.
Wow.
It's very tedious to you do that with Pro Tools, though, because Pro Tools is a very, very deep. It's like Logic. Logic's very deep too.
Yeah.
It's a very deep, deep program. Very deep.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can put your cursor one place, and there's about five different things that can happen there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think that I don't know how well that app works. The app works great for if things like word processing and stuff. That app is wonderful. I've already gone to a low vision center and learned some tricks, but I'll still play guitar, but it'll just be such a drag for me not to be able to do Pro Tools and, and go in and record and create tracks from nothing. That's such a joy to do, man. It's just a wonderful experience to do that. I'll still play. Teaching myself right now to play without looking.
That's great.
Yeah,
I've done that a few times. I went ahead and put on a blindfold and saw what I could, just to see what I could do. You know what I mean?
It's amazing. You can adapt pretty quickly. It's just when you got to do a lot of jumping around up and down the fretboard, that gets a little tough.
Yeah.
Especially if you go from a Strat to a Les Paul, when scale is different.
Yeah.
The 12th fret is also all of a sudden not where you want it to be.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? Absolutely.
And so that's a little tricky, but I'm getting a handle on it, I think.
You know? That's great.
Yeah.
So you're going to also be doing something with this new Jason, Jason Becker project, huh?
Yeah. He asked me quite a while ago if I would play on the album. And of course, it'd be a thrill to play on his. He writes beautiful music, so anytime I can get to play on that, that's a wonderful thing. Yeah. So he hasn't finished the track yet, so I'm waiting on him to get the track all finished the way he wants it, and then when he sends it over, I'll overdub some guitar stuff for him.
That sounds great. That sounds really.
Oh yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah,
that's a joy.
For sure. And now you've also got something else going on with Chris Bell.
Yeah, Chris Bell, my new buddy is. We're doing it. We did a film. He wrote the score, and what he sort of did was he hired me just to do the guitar stuff that he wanted. So it was great. It was a really great way to work, actually, because. Pro Tools has really gotten itself sorted out for film.
Mm-hmm.
You can put the video in a track,
mm-hmm.
so it's really cool. You can actually move the video. You can move your music around and see where it lays in the track. It's really very cool. So he would send me his basic tracks, and then we would talk to each other on the phone and find out where he would like to have guitars. And then he just sort of let me go. It got to the point where he just said, well, here's my score. Put guitars on where you think they should go.
Mm-hmm.
So he gave me all kinds of freedom, and I had a blast. Because I figured, I'll give him plenty, and then he could just edit out what he doesn't want or use what he wants. So we actually had a lot of fun doing this score. It was a blast. So we're hoping to do more of that. That was a lot of fun.
That's great. That's great. Yeah, it's a blast to do that type. It's a whole other type of creation, which is
great. The music is it's a different kind of music. It has to be very emotional music because your job is to underscore the emotion in
mm-hmm.
the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and sure. I mean, it's weird because if you do a good job, you don't remember hearing the music. But which is really kind of a shame. But if you do a really good job, I mean, I didn't know for many, many years that the movie Psycho was scored by a guy by the name of Bernard Herrmann, who was the genius. That whole score is just a string quartet. I never realized that. I had no idea. I thought there was all kinds of stuff going on. All he used was a string quartet through the whole score.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
And it's amazing. Amazing score. So that's the challenge of doing film music. And it's a wonderful, fun challenge to try to create, try to underscore the emotion that's going on or to lead the viewer into the next scene. There's all these cool kind of things you get to do with film score music that I really love.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's great, and it's great. You're so busy between all of that, and you're also writing a monthly column for Guitar Player magazine.
That's been a lot of fun too.
Yeah, that is, and it's great. I always look forward to it now. I hope you're gonna be doing it indefinitely at this point, or
yeah, unless Mike fires me.
Well.
I'm always teasing him about firing.
Oh, Mike's a good guy. I like Mike.
Mike's a terrific guy, and I'm enjoying doing the column.
Yeah.
So unless I run out of stuff to write about and stuff.
Oh, that's not gonna happen. I can't
just make stuff up. If I have to, you know
what I mean? I actually had Mike on the show. He was great. Great conversation.
Yeah, he's a cool guy, man. Yeah. He's a great guy.
Yeah. Before I let you go, I've got to ask you about your experience when you guys were recording "Welcome to My Nightmare." You were hanging out. The legend has it, you were hanging out, and Jack Douglas popped his head out of a studio and said, "Hey, I need some help in here with these Aerosmith guys."
That's pretty much it. I was in New York. There was a great studio there called the Record Plant.
Yeah.
Which I think it's moved, and I think it's called just the Plant now or something.
Yeah, something like
that. I don't remember what's happened to it. Oh, man, it was a great, my favorite studio in the whole world at that time. Because Jack Douglas, when I met him at that time, he was an engineer, and that guy always got the most incredible guitar sounds.
Mm-hmm.
So I always look for him. You know, boy, I hope Jack's here, man, because I know then I'm going to get a great guitar sound. And I was sitting in the lobby. The Record Plant had a tiny little lobby. It only had like one little couch, you know, and I was having a cigarette. It's back when I used to smoke, and I was having a cigarette. Bob is in Studio A, which was this big studio, doing an edit on 2-inch tape, so I wanted to leave him alone. It's nerve-wracking in those days. You had to cut and tape together 2-inch tape, so real nerve-wracking. So I stayed out of the control room, having a cigarette in the lobby, and right across from me was the door to Studio C, and it's a smaller studio. And the door pops open, and Jack Douglas said, "Do you feel like playing?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I'm just sitting here, you know." So he runs into Studio A and asks Bob if it's okay if he borrows me for a little while to play a solo. And Bob said, "Sure, I'm editing." So Jack grabbed this great old twin. They had a Tweed twin in there that just was the best-sounding amp ever. And he grabbed that. We went in the Studio C. I go in the door. I grab my SG. I think it might have been the TV special. I grab the TV special. I go in the studio, and there's the band, and there's my friend Ray Colcord, who co-produced the album. He was the keyboard player with the Lou Reed Rock and Roll Animal album.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were co-producing, Jack and Ray. And I go in the studio. We plug everything in. I do one pass, and Jack said, "Man, it sounds great, except you're kind of stepping on the vocals." And I said, "Well, I don't have any vocals in the headphones." And he said, "Oh, I'm sorry, forgot to put them in." So he puts in the vocals, and I do a second pass, and he said, "Fine, that's great." So, and I was kind of like, "Well, wait a minute, I'm just kind of warming up, you know?" Because I used to like overplay a bit to just get my fingers warmed up.
Right.
And that's what I was doing, and I thought maybe I didn't think it was, maybe it wasn't good, you know. Jack said, "No, that's great, man. That's great. You're done." That was it. That was it. That's how that happened. Dick Wagner had already played the on the live version, or the pseudo live version,
right,
which was the second half. Dick had already done his, so, and I didn't even hear that until later.
That's amazing.
I didn't know what that was. I didn't know where that came from.
You know, it's so funny too, because I grew up in New York. And we as Aerosmith fans were like, "This sounds different."
Yeah, I know, it's weird, isn't it?
It's like, this doesn't sound like the rest of it. What's going on
here?
Yeah,
I know. Well, I don't know how they got away with it, but they did.
They did, and it didn't come out for years. Nobody knew about it for years.
Well, that was the thing. See, in those days, man, record labels were getting a little testy about signing groups to the label and then finding out that the group didn't play half the record, that mm-hmm. there was somebody else came in and played their parts.
Right.
And a lot of labels were getting really pissed off about that. And so Jack took me aside and said, "Look, man," he paid me cash, I don't remember how much, and he said, "Look, you can't say anything about this, because if it gets out, the label might drop these guys."
Oof.
And I said, "Okay, man, I'm not going to say a word." I'd already done that. I ghosted on Billion Dollar Babies too.
Right.
I didn't get credit for that either. And for the same basic reason, is that the label might have gotten a little upset. Look, we were just, you know, Bob was just trying to make as good a record as he possibly could, and so was Jack.
Sure.
And for whatever reason, Joe was having trouble getting that solo. Right. Now, I don't know what was going on. I never found out what the problem was. All I know is that he called me in to play, and I played, and then that was it. You know, I didn't even think about it until all of a sudden I started hearing that on the radio.
Right.
And I thought, oh, well, that's great. The guy's got the album out. You know, maybe they're touring. You know, I never gave it much thought after that, except I started hearing it on the radio, like, a lot. And I thought, wow, that's really weird, man. They're playing the hell out of that thing, you know.
Right.
And I'm still keeping my mouth shut, you know. And I don't know, maybe 10 years later, when Aerosmith broke up, the first time they broke up, almost 2 days later, like almost the next day, somebody called me. some journalist called me and said, Steve, can we write about you? Was that you on Aerosmith? It's like, oh, now I can say something because the band's broke up.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, Dick Wagner and I both got deluged with all kinds of journalists wanting to know the story about that Aerosmith, the train kept rolling. He said he got about 8-10 interviews all for that very reason, and so did I.
Wow.
I was getting people calling me from all over the place wanting to know. That was you, wasn't it? Was that you on Aerosmith? Yeah, okay, it was me, you know, because I didn't figure I was going to hurt anything. Now the band broke up.
Yeah, for sure, for sure.
But then when they reformed, then I thought, oh, maybe I let the cat out of the bag. Wow. But by that time, nobody really cared.
By that point, we all knew that, you know, Clapton played on While My Guitar Gently Weeps. And,
yeah, there was a lot of that going on. Yeah. Man. There was a lot of that going on. And I had mixed emotions about it because, of course, I played on it, and it would have been nice if I'd gotten credit for it. And
yeah.
Instead of now having to, like, years later, I mean, for the next 20 years, I've talked about that.
Right.
You know? And if I had just had a name on the album, I wouldn't have to be talking about it all the time. Yeah. You know. But it's okay because, you know, there was a lot of that going on in those days. So and there's a lot of stuff that come out. I mean, like after Dick and I. Did so many interviews. We did an interview together about it. I think in Vintage Guitar Magazine, we did an interview together about it.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, all this other stuff starts coming out. Like, well, such Rick Derringer played on this, and
right.
Steve Lukather played on this.
Oh, and, yeah.
Know, all of a sudden, it's coming out all over the place.
Yeah, you but know? You know, it's funny
all
because
that's pretty common.
I mean, if you look back and you look at the Wrecking Crew, I mean,
yeah. Oh, they worked their butts off.
Yeah,
They made Dick and I look like idiots. I mean, we didn't do anything compared to what those guys did.
Yeah, I mean, everything from Sonny and Cher to Simon and Garfunkel.
Everything.
Yeah. And then, you know, movies and music, of course. Movies and TV, of course. But
absolutely. And there are things that Ry Cooder did that people don't know about. Ry Cooder played on a lot of Paul Revere and the Raiders albums.
Wow.
Along with Burton Cummings.
What?
I mean, not Burton Cummings. I'm sorry, James Burton. Sorry.
Oh, James Burton.
I'm old. I get names confused. James Burton and Ry Cooder, if you look at some of the old Paul Revere and the Raiders albums, they're given credit, finally, on the back of the albums.
Wow.
Those guys were playing on all kinds of records.
Wow.
I think they did some Monkees records, too, along with the Wrecking Crew.
Yeah, Wrecking Crew. And
some of the other people. But
Neil Diamond.
Yeah, Neil. But there was a lot of that going on in those days. Just that when certain ones hit, though, then everybody goes a little berserk, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and I think it's a little unfair because it was done by everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right. I
used to hate when somebody said, "Well, what's the matter with Joe? Couldn't cut it?" No, you know, it was nothing like that. I think if anything, he probably had tried playing it a bunch of times and he hit a block. I don't know how many times there were when Dick and I were in the studio. I would hit a block, I couldn't come up with solo, and I'd hand the guitar to Dick, and he'd get it one take,
right?
Or vice versa, you know, where he might get a block and I would come in and that happens to guitar players, you know, that certain tracks just. You play it a couple of times, and then all of a sudden you hit a stone wall. You can't come up with it.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes it just gets stymied. It's a stymie. It's just like, what do you do?
Yeah. And that's all I thought it was. I thought Joe just probably hit a wall, you know, and he couldn't come up with anything fresh.
Yeah. Yeah, and Jack was on the clock, and he had to get the job done.
Oh, yeah. They had to get – I know their backs were against the wall. They had to get the album done.
Yeah.
And they just didn't have time, you know. Yeah. They had to get something done. So. Yeah. It just happened to work out that way. That's all.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I know for that band, I mean, you know, there was that album didn't do great. It did okay. And then
it sort of put them on the map.
It did. It got them out there touring and opening for other acts, which was really good. And then, you know, I know that when Toys in the Attic was being recorded, they basically went into the studio being told, if this isn't good, you guys are done.
Well, let me tell you something. Joe Perry didn't have any trouble playing guitar because
somebody,
if you listen to his guitar playing on, what is it, Walk This Way? Was that the one
we
had the other day?
Yeah.
Man, there's some great guitar stuff.
Oh, it's unreal. And same with Brad Whitford. Brad Whitford is a technical genius.
Yeah, Brad's a great player,
too. Yeah,
both of them are.
I ran into Brad last, I think it was May or April at the Dallas Guitar Show.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
He and I were standing over at Electroharmonix, and I was like, man, for years I've been trying to figure out how to play Toys in the Attic properly. He goes, well, let me show you my part. And actually, and he pulls out a guitar and he plays it. And it was just like, it was so weird. It was all inversions and, you know, two finger chords. And it was, you know, it was like, really? I would have never figured that out.
Yeah, I know. See, that's the weird thing, isn't it, man? Some of that stuff, you hear it and you think, No, it's got to be more complicated.
Right, exactly.
Don't tell me that. I've been working my ass off on this thing. It's two notes? Don't tell me that. Yeah, I know the feeling. That's happened to me a few times.
Well, Steve, I can't thank you enough for taking the time out today to talk to me, man.
No worries, man. It's my pleasure.
You really have been, you know, it's like people like you and Waddy Wattel.
Yeah,
you guys have been in my record collection since the get-go.
Good.
And and I've learned so much from you and folks like that, and it's been great to have you rattling around in my head all these years.
Yeah, good. I just hope I didn't say anything where you might get sued or something.
No, not at all.
Okay.
Not at all. All right, well, hang on 1 second, but we're going to sign off here, man. Thanks so much.
Okay.
All right. Well, there you have it. How cool was that? Unreal. This is why I love doing this. This is why I love doing this. That's why I want to do it. To talk to people like that who have had such a rich history and have made an impact on so many people. I mean, think of the impact on radio alone, rock radio alone. Somewhere in the world, something that he's playing on is being played right now. And right now. And right now. I mean, not everybody can say that. That's, to me, is special. That is really, really cool. Well, I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did doing it for you. If you have any other information or you want to find out more information on Steve, you can go to stevehunter.com. And get ready for that new record, which is going to be really great. I'm really glad that he's doing all these new projects. It's really great. Meantime, we got to get out of here, but don't forget, we got a lot of cool stuff coming up for the rest of the month into January, February, lots of cool stuff. Very excited. And lots of other announcements coming in the new year that I'm really looking forward to sharing with you as well. Meantime, we're going to get going. Just remember, take care of each other, take care of yourselves, keep on playing, and please buy it, don't steal it, and we'll see you on the next episode of Guitar Radio Show. Peace!
Now everybody say, F you, Ed!
I like this crowd already.
Production.
New episodes of Guitar Radio Show air every Wednesday on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Podbay, Player FM, Podomatic, and of course on GuitarRadioShow.com.